Netter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA 1977 on Twitter.
Nimmer's Netter, just talking to teachers.
Hello and welcome to this week's Half-Term Nailers Natter, and this week I am joined by Steve Oakes and Martin Griffin, and we're discussing their VESPA system, looking at the importance of non-cognitive skills in educational success. So Steve was the Assistant Director of Bluecoat Sixth Form, and he has a passion for sports psychology and improving students' performance through changing attitudes. He's currently completing a PhD in VESPA at MMU. And Martin is a writer and educational speaker. He was previously deputy head teacher at Bluecoat School in Oldham, and he has a keen interest in raising attainment through culture and expectations. And this episode really allowed me to get back to the roots of the podcast, as both Steve and Martin draw on their combined 40 years of experience and lots of educational research. So they pull together current thinking from psychology, business, and sport to inspire, motivate, and support students, ensuring they achieve their full potential. And their VESPA model outlines five key components to success, which they will outline later in the podcast, but these are namely vision, effort, systems, practice, and attitude. And it's a fantastic episode and a fascinating episode, as both Martin and Steve speak with such authority and gravitas about their model. Before we get into this, we can hear from our roving collaborator, Michelle, who is in conversation with friend of the show and previous guest, John Collier, who is discussing TDT's CPD Excellence Hub in Stoke. So over to you, Michelle.
Thanks, Phil. I'm here in Stoke with TDT Expert Advisor and Director of Teaching and Learning at Britannia Teaching School Alliance, John Collier. John, you've been closely involved with TDT for the past few years, supporting our Excellence Hub project. But prior to this, had already been supporting a series of network hubs around Stoke. Could you talk to us about why network hubs are so powerful and some of your reasons for championing this type of work?
Hi, Michelle. Yes, absolutely. For me, you know, networks, they begin with that quote, don't they? A really fabulous quote. The most valuable resource that all teachers have is each other. I just love that. And the mantra behind it, you know, is key to the success of collaboration and networks. Because collaboration is growth. It's about people working together in order for both to flourish, really. I'd say what we did here in Stoke, how we grew those networks, is we started with something called Core 4. So going back to when the changes were made to the primary national curriculum, we realised that there wasn't going to be any central funding from DfE, so we had to do something about it ourselves, and we created four networks, so English, Maths, Science and Computing. And those networks were facilitated by two SLEs who were experts in those areas. And so we got together from across the city, other subject leaders who were specialists, and those networks became one of the most robust, the most popular ones that we've really done since we began as a teaching school. And they're still 7 years on. They're really strong today. So I think, you know, that's a testament to the power of collaboration and networking.
Yeah. Really interesting. Do you have any advice actually for teachers who are not currently involved in the scale of networking collaboration? Where should they start?
Definitely. I mean, in this current climate where we're talking about teaching schools and schools working together and maths and all of that kind of thing, if you're already in some kind of formal relationship, then, you know, get out there and talk to colleagues. If you're not, can you get yourself invited along? If you've got an informal relationship with a local school, can you arrange a teach meet? Can you, you know, start very small in terms of just getting yourself invited and get talking with colleagues that you wouldn't normally converse with? I guess that's a way of doing it. For us, again, we've got a teaching assistant network that I facilitate locally, and that's from it happens in a secondary school, and all of the TAs from the feeder primaries come together. And they traditionally haven't had those kind of relationships. They didn't really talk to each other. And now there's a group of about 60 TAs from five or six different settings who regularly come together every month. And we talk about the latest, you know, evidence, the latest research. And that's a really powerful way of getting people in a room.
Yeah, really valuable. Could you pinpoint what has been the most valuable element of hub work for you professionally?
I think it's about empowering others and it's seeing growth in others. So my own background is I became an SLE in 2012 and I've done an awful lot of facilitation of networks in that time. But then of course, you've got to build capacity. It's about succession planning. So it's not just about one person or two people. Actually, how can you then spread that? How can you bring on the next layer of facilitators? So empowerment through coaching, through train the trainer facilitation, and getting those middle leaders, if you like, coming through and really taking on networks and sharing their expertise. That's the power of it.
Brilliant. Thanks, John. If you'd like to know more about networks like John's or where your nearest TDT-supported hub might be, go online at tdttrust.org and head to the regional events page. Back to you in the studio, Phil.
Thank you, Michelle, and thank you, John. Great to hear from you again. So now we're moving to our first ever Skype group call conversation with Steve and Martin, all of us in separate locations, the wonders of technology. And it's testament to Steve and Martin's double act that they are absolutely in sync perfectly, despite none of us being in the same room. So we're discussing their book, The A-Level Mindset, as on Nailers Natter, we like to cover all phases of education. And this episode will be especially beneficial to those of you who teach A-Level, but some of the strategies are universally applicable. So now over to the Natter with Steve and Martin. Okay, so Steve and Martin, welcome to Nailers Natter.
Thank you. Good evening.
Thank you very much for having us, Phil.
No problem. An absolute pleasure. So we're going to do our usual introductory question. So we can start with you, Martin. Can you just tell listeners a little bit about your journey to this point and what you're working on at the moment?
Yeah, sure. My name's Martin Griffin. I've been a teacher for the last 22 years. An English teacher started out as, and I've been a head of department, head of faculty, a head of year, an assistant head teacher, and a deputy head director of sixth form. That's where the work began, really, that we're going to discuss tonight, the VESPA work, the focus on non-cognitive skills and their impact on student performance. So as throughout my career, I've been fascinated, really, with what makes successful students, how they think, behave, and operate differently to others. And that was the seeds, really, of the piece of work that we began together in 2010.
And Steve Oakes here, and my career had a bit of an unusual start, I suppose, in terms of an educational career. I spent 6 years in the military before deciding to become a teacher, but it was there that I really learned, I suppose, the importance of character. I was either lucky or stupid enough to volunteer to complete the Royal Marines Commando course, parachute regiment selection and training. And it was that real focus on character that not only led to my own development of my character, really, I think something that period particularly showed me the importance of mental toughness. But then it sort of led on to an interest in sports psychology. And at the end of my military career, decided that I'd go and do a degree in sports science and try and focus on the sports psychology aspect. But that then really started my career as a PE teacher in my early days. And since those early days, I've worked in four different organisations, schools and colleges, all mainly based in the northwest of England, three 11 to 18 high schools, one big sixth form college. And but it was only really in the last 10 years or so working with Martin that I really started to explore and develop this interest in developing students' non-cognitive skills, the character aspects, and really, really applying that to my teaching career.
Brilliant, brilliant. There's so much to talk about in the podcast, and we're going to get into that in a minute. I just wondered, Steve, if you're quite close to your computer, do you reckon you can just a little bit, I don't know, it's the software probably, but it's just flashing quite a lot of red when you're coming through. I just want to make sure that, you know, everyone. Go on, sorry.
Is that better?
Yeah, that is better. That's better, yeah. Yeah, thank you. Thank you. I do it all the time. I'm always hunched over the microphone, and it always comes through way too loud, some of the things that I say. Okay, right, so back into it. So in terms of, you've talked about your journeys there, and fascinating journeys they both are, but in terms of your journey together, this kind of came out of the basement office with A-level results analysis in front of you. So tell listeners a little bit more about that.
Yeah, that was an interesting summer. We began working together in 2010, and of course each summer like schools up and down the country, our head teacher would be demanding a fine-tooth comb level of reporting on precisely what had happened at A-level. And as we were going through students, almost on a case-by-case basis, it became very clear that those students with glittering careers at GCSE weren't necessarily the success stories we were beginning to pick out at A-level. And I suppose it was the first time that I, as a teacher, had questioned the kind of linear relationship between poor performance at one key stage and the next, and began to realise that learning journeys aren't smooth. Learning curve is a bit of a, I suppose, a misleading metaphor, and that there was a significant non-cognitive element. Steve and I were picking out success stories and saying, well, we knew that kid was going to be okay because of, and then out would come a list of non-cognitive characteristics: determination, hard work, ambition, commitment. And I think that's where it all started, Steve, didn't it?
Yeah, and I think, I mean, the question that I suppose we both were interested in, that rather embarrassingly we didn't know the answer to after, you know, after 10 years teaching or so, we became really fascinated in what makes a successful learner. You know, what do they do differently? Did we really understand it? And actually, I think it turned out that we probably didn't. So taking that question and then beginning to explore what do successful students actually do differently? Of course, teaching and learning has a big impact on students, but perhaps what they do away from the classroom might have equal weighting, and that's what we became fascinated in. What are they doing differently?
And that, I think, almost immediately after that summer, Steve, was the term where we began watching high-performing students very closely, wasn't it? I remember both of us really deciding upon a cohort of students who were performing particularly well and just going to watch what they were like. What are they like in classrooms? What are they like during a discussion or debate? What are they like during a practical activity? What are they like once the class finishes and then in the corridors and common rooms of the college or school afterwards? And then through discussion with them, what are they like, you know, over the weekend or in their evenings? And we began to slowly unpick what it was that these people were doing.
And I think only then, and particularly like you've mentioned there, Martin, the discussions that we had with students around what are you actually doing differently, or what are you doing, what's your approach to study, just opened up some areas around non-cognitive skills that we perhaps hadn't considered early on in our career. And I think we were quite surprised at how many teachers weren't aware of these sort of things that they were doing. But also on top of that, I think it just combined with us becoming really interested in, you know, quite a significant amount of work that seemed to be being published around this time.
Yes, yeah. Sorry, I was just going to cut it at that point. I thought this is a perfect chance to ask the next question. So in terms of, you know, this podcast is, the reason for being in the first place was to shine a light on evidence and research-based practice, but your work is extremely rigorous and steeped in a lot of research. And you talk early in the book, so that's the A-level mindset I'm talking about, that you're both standing on the shoulders of giants. So which giants influenced your work on the A-level mindset?
Well, that's a good question. I'll pick a few off, Steve, first, and then you can jump in.
Yeah.
I think Steve's right to point out that it was a particularly fertile time for the kind of study that we were, that there might have been something in the air. We were particularly interested in things. And then I think I do remember Dan Coyle's that the talent code must have come out about 2010. That must have been the summer we started. And we were fascinated by Daniel Coyle's examination of what made successful learners. And that must have been off the back of, I think, Matthew Saeed's Bounce as well. We'd got kind of quite evangelical about success being grown, not born. So we were interested in that. And then, of course, I mean, we could pick off Carol Dweck's work, Angela Duckworth's work. But I think it was Coyle, it was Oh, let me pick off one other. Gladwell's Outliers must have been around about then as well. Mm-hmm. And that led us to Anders Ericsson's work on practice. So there's my starter for 10. What about you, Steve?
Well, I was just going to say this whole, I mean, from what I remember, I remember you buying all the stuff in our team, the talent code, that really got us thinking about perhaps the importance of this other area. And it then just became a little bit of a book club, didn't it, for quite a long period of time, where we were just, you know, and because I think so much was being published at the time, like you say, it was just the right time to be looking at this sort of work. And, you know, Csikszentmihalyi's work around flow was something we became really fascinated in, how some students got themselves into flow states, others didn't. But it was all just trying to piece it all together, I think, as well, which became quite interesting that we were, as we started looking at the research, what became clear is that you can understandably, the researchers often have their particular focus, and it did seem quite narrow to us at the time. And we seemed to be just pulling strands from all these different pieces of work, different areas, and spending what seemed to be quite a long time to put this jigsaw together, if I remember rightly, in terms of how we started, how it shaped our thinking.
That's how I recall it too. And I remember particularly, Steve, you bringing the work of Peter Clough to us. That must have been a couple of years into the project.
Yeah, we had, I think it's worth, we had a year of 11 who was very interested. He'd stumbled across the work of Peter Clough, and his model around mental toughness was really interesting in terms of it added a bit more of a multidimensional approach, unlike maybe Dweck and Duckworth that seemed to be quite narrow. His model seemed to have a bit more of a holistic approach. It was language that was meaningful to teachers, that the constructs meant something to staff and students. So then it gave us the idea, and having spoken to Peter Clough as well, he wasn't convinced that perhaps mental toughness was the right model for education, because he developed that work out of sport. So it was, again, trying to take just pieces from all these different areas of research, but also from our own, trying to put the big jigsaw together from, I would say we probably spent a year trying to figure out through student focus groups, watching observations, talking to teachers, parents, you know, what are the students doing differently? And then I suppose it was that moulding of all those ideas that we ended up with the VESPA model.
We did.
And talking of the VESPA model, in terms of all of this theory that you were taking at that time, how did you go about putting that theory into practice with the VESPA model?
Well, pretty soon after we had begun to kind of distill and codify this work, it became quite clear to us both that what we were missing, we were throwing all sorts of money at this, trying to find a book or a program that would put together some experiences, tools, tactics, strategies that we could share with our students. And we were coming up blank every time we went out searching. So in the end, we ended up raiding, I suppose, the world of sports psychology, business education, to try and find something that was interactive, reflective, that encouraged thought. And I think a key text in the early stages was Damien Hughes' book. What's that one called, Steve?
Liquid thinking. Yeah.
And we quickly realised, actually, if you ask the right questions and you give students space to respond and perhaps set them a thought experiment and encourage them to reflect and then perhaps they record their answers, that might then become the basis of an interesting coaching conversation, which then surfaces perhaps some awareness of a particular habit or characteristic. So Steve and I began designing our own kind of, I suppose, borrowing, magpieing stuff that we could find, adjusting and adapting it, writing some of them from scratch, and ending up with what we have in the books now. which are, well, I mean, talk us through them, Steve.
There's well, I was going to say, activities, aren't there? Just before that point, for the listeners who are not familiar with Vesper, it might be worth just talking through how we grew together. So should I kick us off with, and we'll take each one in turn and just do a brief overview of how we decided to collectively bring the work together.
Go for it.
So the Vesper element of the model, this is what we decided upon, what the data seemed to be fairly strong on. And so the first element of the model is vision. And vision, I suppose, we not so much underestimated, we just hoped it wouldn't turn out to be as important as it did do in our data anyway. But vision is all about students being clear about the purpose, the passion, having some element of goal orientation, being clear on what they wanted to achieve. In our vision, we'll talk about this later, but we were quite clear on it not having to link necessarily to a specific occupation, but being more aware of why they were doing what they're doing and what they wanted to achieve.
Yeah, effort was that's pretty self-explanatory. That was the number of hours of independent study students were putting in. There was a strong correlation between effort and success. Systems
was probably again one of the elements of the model we underestimated, was around organization and planning. We found that students who are low on systems tend to not have obviously a system for planning the time, organizing the work, and in fact some of the low system students we were observing were losing up to 40% of their course material as they went through the year, simply because they didn't have a method for recording information.
Practice was, I think Doug Lamov's been a guest on the podcast, hasn't he? So his work, I think Practice Perfect was the book that had come out around about that time, and we'd become kind of geekily obsessed with that. And we became very focused on the idea of utility. What did you spend your time doing, and how much impact did it have on your progress and performance? So that's the P.
And then finally, the attitude, the one that's, you know, possibly one of the harder ones to shift. But we found a number of different aspects to this. There was confidence, obviously, confidence in ability, but also interpersonal confidence. Did the student feel willing to come and ask for help? There was emotional control. How did the students respond in high-stakes situation? There was academic resilience in terms of how did the student respond when feedback hadn't necessarily gone their way. And we also included growth mindset within our attitude framework, because we thought it was a really important concept to consider, no matter what the age of the student.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Brilliant. So in terms of the next bit of the podcast, what I'm going to look at, I mean, you've got so many books to choose from. So obviously, listeners will be aware, you've got the student mindset, you've got the GCSE mindset, you've got the workbooks that go with that. But I wanted to focus, if it's okay, just to change the audience a little bit, because we've done lots of stuff on primary, done secondary, to talk about the A-level mindset. Is that okay?
Yeah.
So if we take chapter by chapter through the A-level mindset, and we do talk, you know, in detail about the Vesper model and how to kind of translate that to classrooms. So if we start with the V, you know, we hear a lot about vision, and you've mentioned about there, you know, we hear vision a lot in education. So what do you mean by vision? You've touched on, but how can teachers guide sort of vision activities?
Yeah, that's a great question, and that cuts to the heart of how we support students in this. I'll pick off a couple of things, and Steve will probably jump in afterwards. What I'd emphasise, I think, is first of all the difference between be goals and do goals. We found when we were asking our students, "What do you want to be?" Their responses were quite limited, because the question was the wrong one. So often you sit down with a low vision student, what do you want to be? And they might say, I want to be a lawyer. I want to be rich. I don't care, but I want to be famous. We were struggling with these kind of responses. I want to be a vet. And they were super specific and often supported with very little notion of what that might look like. So one of the first steps we took was to move away from be to do. What do you want your day to look like? If you've got 12 hours to spend, what do you want to be doing with that kind of non-renewable resource of time? All right, you'll be able to earn a little bit more money, but you'll never get that 12 hours back. So what is your perfect working day like? Are you going to be with teams? Are you going to be in or outdoors? Is it going to be high stakes, high reward? Do you imagine it looking differently? And shifting from be to do was one of those very practical changes in focus that significantly improved, I think, the kind of support we could give students.
Yeah, the other area, particularly as they move into sixth form, was the distinction between push and pull goals, I think, became quite interesting to us. The idea that lower down the school, I'm not suggesting this is what all teachers do, but we felt in our context, there was an element of pushing students towards goals. And when you've got push goals, obviously there might be an element of resistance there because the goal isn't particularly exciting for the student. So it was a move from, right, particularly in sixth form, we're now we're thinking a pull goal is something that excites you particularly. It's something that will get you up in the morning. The more likely that if you've got a pull goal, you're much more likely then to actually take action. And that was the other big part of how we implemented vision, was moving students away from just dreaming, basically, having these dreams of what they wanted to do, to taking action to make sure they actually happened.
And I'd pick off one other thing, I think, about vision, and that is that self-awareness plays a strong part in that. So a lot of our activities encourage students to think about who they were and what they stood for, what success looked like for them, so that they could begin to see their situation. You know, 10,000 feet, 20,000 feet, they could look down at the situation and begin to conceive of what it was they valued, to take themselves out of a context that might include parents, tutors, teachers, older and younger brothers, and begin to conceive of themselves as someone with agency. So a lot of our goal setting began at those points. I think it's worth pointing out, Phil, what it wasn't was careers advice. Mm-hmm. And that's really important to point out.
No, absolutely. In terms of the next section, so, you know, I've been lucky to see you speak on this particular topic. So there's a couple of activities that I'm going to pull out just on a personal level that I enjoy, if that's okay. But if we move to the E, I mean, effort is such an interesting and somewhat controversial idea. And I was interested that you said before about students that did well at GCSE didn't necessarily transfer to do well at A level. And I wonder how much effort has to do with that. So why is it so important, and what can teachers do to help it? And I love the 1 to 10 effort activity scale, for example. So if you can talk a little bit about that as an activity.
Yeah, let's pick that one off. We were interested, Steve and I, in the notion that perceptions of effort are relative. So the low effort students don't identify as low effort. They don't see themselves as low effort. They conceive of themselves as average, at least, perhaps above, and surround themselves by people who work similar amounts so that they can normalise the levels of effort that they're putting in. We're all guilty of this, aren't we? All of us at various points in our lives. And the 1 to 10 scale is an opportunity for students to try and give a numerical score to the amount of effort they think they've put in across a period of time, except, and here's the interesting bit, you don't give them any useful descriptors to make that decision. You say 0 is low effort, 5 is like average effort, and 10 is really high levels of effort. And what we find then is students cluster around 6 or 7, regardless of how much they've actually worked, because their perception of themselves puts them about there. Lots of interesting studies about this. And it's only afterwards that you can then say, well, here's the amount of effort that students declared last year and the grades they got as a result. So you might then say 10 out of 10, you need to be working at about 20 hours a week in order to give yourself that score. And of course, then low effort students tumble from their original score of six or seven to a one or a two. And it's a moment of kind of stark realization for them, which I think is a starting point for discussing, well, if we're going to make an informed choice about effort, we as an organization need to give you as much information as possible, i.e. how hard did last year's year group work and what grades did they get as a result?
And you're talking about what can teachers do about it. From my point of view, the as well as what mine's just discussed, which is the starting point, you've got to be able to quantify it. The bit that I've become interested in is high flow spaces. So particularly for sixth form students, about creating spaces that encourage students to get into, as Csikszentmihalyi calls it, that flow state. And some environments, we're always looking out for this now whenever we visit sixth form or schools with sixth forms, is what are the spaces like that the students have designed for them to work in? And sometimes, and we were guilty of this when we first started working together, our spaces just weren't high floor spaces. They were designed to actually for leisure time. Actually, there was bean bags, there was spaces to just lounge around in. And if you want students to put more effort in, you've got to encourage them to get into that flow state, and you can do that quite easily if you create the right environment for them to actually work in. So we did a lot of work with our students about what does a high floor space look like for you. And it was interesting in the research part when we did, and they talked about one of the worst places for them to work, students identified, was actually at home in the bedroom. So they were saying this is there's so many distractions there, it's just not a good place. So we did a lot about what spaces are effective to work in, where it gets you in that state quicker. And I think if you're looking for a quick win around effort, that would certainly be my number one recommendation. Look at your spaces that you're creating.
Great, great stuff. So in terms of the next section, so we're going into the S, and listeners will know that I absolutely love a system. So if you talk about two kinds of system in the A-level mindset, tell us a little bit about those.
Yeah, I'll pick one off, and that's a system for organising resources. What I found really interesting, looking at the way students work post-16, is that they have to undo a lot of what has become part of their kind of skeleton, their operating system, to use a different metaphor. We teach organisation of resources by chronology at Key Stage 3 and 4. So students are used to using exercise books and recording ideas in terms of time. And then what we were doing was then giving them lever arch files and dividers post-16 and saying, right, now you're going to sort your work in a different way. It's going to be thematic rather than chronological. But we weren't particularly explicit about what that might look like. What's a file divider for? What is it dividing? What goes before the divider? What goes after the divider? And why is that? The idea that you might organize work according to theme or topic or concept was one that was difficult for our students to grasp, understandably, and that they floundered with, and we didn't quite understand why. So part of our systems activities encourage students to understand holistically how a course is working and how its subcomponents connect to each other.
And the second part is it's all about systems to organise their time so that students can complete key tasks to deadlines. And it became really clear to us in the research that even students who you might think are quite organised often don't even operate on a to-do list. In fact, they'll have no system to record anything. They might not have planners, diaries. And this is where the work of Scott Belsky became really useful for us, because he had one tool that I think is one of my favourites for systems, which is called the Energy Line, which is just a very simple, straightforward way of organising your tasks that you've got. It's very visual, and students just love, well, I'll say love, that might be a bit ambitious in terms of the term, but they really took advantage of the fact that they could plan in this way, and it actually reduces a lot of stress. And certainly in for sixth form students, when we're talking about students who are feeling the pressure and they're going under with the workload, often it was a lack of system that was causing them a number of problems, and the energy line was just a great tool to help them prioritize, work out what the most important tasks are, work out how much time it would need to get things done. And Scott Belsky's energy line is a fantastic tool to get students into that sort of mindset.
It is. It's from Making Ideas Happen, that one, isn't it? And I think that probably came out around that time as well.
Okay, so moving into the P bit, and you mentioned Doug Lamov before, so I'm going to shamelessly quote a former guest of the podcast, Doug Lamov. I like saying that, by the way. Because I'm similarly geeky about this in terms of all of his work, and massive, massive fan of that. But I think I've done that to death. So moving on, practice should not be punishment. So I said, Doug. So what does the research tell us about practice, and what can teachers do in this area?
Yeah, I'll pick off Csikszentmihalyi's work here. I think I like referring to his map to flow. High flow states arrive when students are doing something that is challenging, but which matches their level of skill and asks them to operate at the edge of their ability. And Csikszentmihalyi has got an interesting kind of array of adjectives to describe what you might feel if the skill versus challenge ratio is a bit off, okay? So he, I think, boredom, apathy, relaxation, are the kind of adjectives he uses to describe highly skilled students who've chosen extremely repetitive work that doesn't challenge them. And what we found, Steve and I and other members of the sixth form team, was that our students would often use precisely those adjectives, boredom, for example, to describe their revision practice or preparation for exams. So that was our way in to looking at, well, high stakes, challenging practice shouldn't be producing this feeling. And I think Lamov's getting at that in a different way, isn't he? By implying that lots of low stakes practice does feel like punishment, and really good practice doesn't. There's a kind of thrill to it almost as students begin to challenge themselves, as they begin to feel control in those high stakes situations. I think we've all met students, haven't we, who say geekily, like 4 weeks into a very intensive revision timetable, I'm really enjoying this, or I'm really into it. They're almost ashamed of it, but they are genuinely engaged because they know that high flow states are quite thrilling places to be. The furthest thing from boredom you could imagine, I think. So that was one element, wasn't it, Steve?
Yeah, the other, the big piece of research that certainly helped shape our thinking was Dunlosky's work on, what are the most effective strategies. And I used this recently with my own daughter, even while she was doing her A-levels in year 13. I recognised that she just wasn't practising in the right way. But one of a typical student putting in the hours, doing a huge amount of practice, but spending it on, as Dunlosky's called it, low utility type activities. And just by, she did ask me actually, which I found interesting, in year 13, she did actually say to me, how do you revise? She didn't really have a good understanding, even at that age, and I've been through an outstanding school, outstanding sixth, she didn't have a good range of strategies. And it was only going through the Dunlosky list with her, and she looked through, and you can see if you have the student mindset in there, that we've modified his language slightly to make it a bit more accessible for students. But she was going through the list, and she had two on the list. She was basically rereading notes and highlighting. And so when she realised she was spending a lot of time just doing those types of activities, and my argument was, well, you could actually spend maybe less time if you did some of what Dunlosky suggests, that high utility. She bought into that idea, and that was the selling point to try and then encourage her to become a little bit more do activities that were more testing, basically getting away, as Martin said, from the shallow lane activities of just rereading stuff and highlighting.
Yeah, and I was just desperately there trying to find this study, because we do quite a lot of stuff for the research school about the fact that you don't necessarily know what is good for you in terms of revision activities. So it's quite an interesting study, but I'm trying to find which one it is. Oh, is it car picky? Is that the one? In terms of which things that people think are good for them and which ones are actually good for them.
Yeah.
And apologies for not knowing which one it is. I'll put it onto the podcast show notes, but I think I'm right.
Absolutely. And it was we asked our students as we were exploring, well, what do students actually do, and we got the list from them. It was interesting how many students thought that reading through class notes was the best strategy for revision. In fact, for a number of students, it was the only strategy for revision.
And we ended up, didn't we, borrowing Seth Godin's language on this one. He makes the distinction between collecting dots and connecting dots. And that's a useful way in with students, I think. I think low practice students collect, high practice students connect them.
And there's definitely a piece of work in terms of, members of staff to understand that, because they've possibly been through a route where that's the method of revision that they've used. And I've had some quite heated discussions around, I highlighted, or, I used, I don't know if they give an example, or I recorded, it depends on the age of the teacher, I recorded myself on a TDK 90 cassette.
Yeah.
And played it back to myself, which is fine. And we always say it's better than nothing, but actually, there are some much better things that you can do.
I used reel to reel, Phil.
and I think there's an argument that doing those activities could be useful. But what my concern with our students and in my daughter's case was that just spending too much, very long hours probably could be reduced by just using more efficient strategies, really. So I think
Steve's right. It's really important to emphasise this. We were not arguing that collecting dots was unnecessary. We were arguing that that was the first stage in a much richer, denser, more complex process.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the evidence on it, people don't read it, and it does seem counterintuitive, like we said there. And I mean, speaking for myself as a strategy, you prefer to reread, it's easier, and it gives you that illusion of fluency that you do understand the work, and you definitely overestimate how much you'll remember, and I guess you kind of underestimate how much you'll forget.
Precisely. For more reading on this, I'd recommend Benedict Carey's book, How We Learn. I don't know whether you know that one, Phil. That's a really good read.
I don't, but I'm adding that to the list, definitely. Okay, so moving on to the A now. So attitude, how do you go about measuring and then, possibly changing students' attitudes?
Steve, do you want to pick this one off?
Yeah, I mean, we've got quite a big interest in using psychometrics of some description to look at how are your students actually thinking. I think we can... And I know there's all, if you, Dweck herself argues there's a lot of problems with using questionnaires of any description with young people. But if I'd argue you need to understand how people are thinking if you're going to actually attempt to try and change attitudes. So we were quite keen on using various questionnaires to try and identify gaps in maybe students' attitude and then how we could actually measure them. So that was a big part of our thinking behind designing interventions and how we could support students. But also, I think a bit that's often overlooked is the micro changes in behaviours that are measurable, that you can see if you're making a difference to students' attitude. So we have quite a long list. Martin, do you want to give us some of the examples? Because I know this is your intro.
I think there are a lot of proxies for attitude that you can collect, measure, and begin to discuss. We were obsessive about collecting the numbers of students who made applications to be senior students, for example, or to take on leadership roles, or the number of students who had begun studying more independently in the LLRC, or the proportion of students who were taking out journals or engaging with our VLE pages or picking up MOOCs and kind of beginning to work through them in their own time. All of those micro measurements gave us a sense of the kind of the breathing, living culture of the organisation and how those behaviours kind of spoke to us about the extent to which we were aligned as an organisation. What do we want for the students? What are the students doing for themselves?
No, absolutely. In terms of implementation, so if you're in charge of, you know, looking at redesigning programs within, you know, the sector we're talking about, how would you go about implementing VESPA and making it happen?
Yeah, the implementation side of things is something, having worked with so many schools and colleges now over the last 18 months, is something we've become quite interested in. It's a whole area in itself. And I think one of the frameworks that we used is the EF's implementation process. We found it's a really useful structure to consider before you actually launch, because I think one of Stephen Tierney's tweets that he put out sometime last year that really stuck with me was about how in education we often give only a very short period of time, I think he said about 5 minutes, to the planning process, when actually we should really be considering it over a six-month period. So thinking through that structure has helped us certainly make things stick a lot more effectively with other schools.
It has. One of the things we've been very keen on is encouraging schools to stack the deck in their favour, okay? You can launch a project and that project can be successful. We know that. We know it's going to be successful before we start, as long as we get the implementation right. And a lot of schools, colleges, will say, as a starting point, we'll think, right, we're beginning in September. It's always September. We're starting in September and we're starting with 2,500 students all at once. And that feels doomed to inevitable failure, when in fact you could begin with a pilot program that deals with two classes, perhaps totaling 45 or 50 students, and that you choose the two members of staff who are most aligned with what you want. They're the keenest, they're the most likely to carry it forward. And then Jim Collins' work here in Good to Great. I know we're name-dropping books left, right, and centre. Hopefully they'll end up in the show notes. But Collins in Good to Great is very clear in the flywheel effect about gathering small steps forward and encouraging others to queue up and join, as opposed to forcing everybody into the implementation process immediately against their will at the start of the academic year.
And the other, I think, important part for us is, you know, step one of the EF process is, you know, after you've identified the area that you're potentially going to try and change, and you've done your research on what's the most effective strategies, is in the second part, so it's really about making the decision that is this the right time for you to implement this particular strategy. And that's something that we work very closely with a school or college on. If they, you know, if they've just been through a big leadership change, or they're implementing a number of different strategies at the same time, this might not be the right time to implement, try and adding something else. So we're usually looking at where are they in the life cycle? Are we in a good place is it a good point to now implement? And then making sure through, you know, using a logic model type format, how we're going to plan this through, what we're going to measure, how we're going to know if it's had impact, and then reviewing that at the end. And then, as Martin said, once we've started small, then year two is when we consider scaling up.
No, absolutely. It's something that we return to time and time again. It's my favourite guidance report. It's what I spend the great deal of my time doing, is looking at implementation. And you know, you're absolutely right about the idea. And it's not through malice sometimes that senior leaders get involved with these projects and then let last for 5 minutes. It's the enthusiasm of launching something new and getting straight from that to seeing what the results are without standing back and thinking, is this right for us? Are the conditions right to do this? Is there a need to do this in the first place? And then, like you said, starting with a small group and getting staff buy-in from it being successful, because there's nothing that gets gets staff's backs up, that's probably a bad phrase, than yet another idea being launched on yet another insect day at the beginning of the year and then fading by Christmas.
Yeah. Right. And I think it's really worth picking off something here about the dip, isn't it? Steve and I are kind of obsessed about the middle section of a project, the bit where the wheels inevitably come off. And what we've begun doing with the schools we're working with is telling them, okay, it might feel good today, but anything worth doing has that dip in the middle. So by December and January, it's going to feel like it isn't working. And you're going to hear the following things from staff you're working with. And you're going to need an if-then plan for every eventuality. So that we can, in a sense, do a pre-mortem of of a project, anticipate all the potential issues that we're going to find halfway through, and make sure that we're planned so that when they do inevitably happen, we have a response to them.
No, absolutely.
I was just going to say, just to quote Doug again, seeing he's been mentioned a couple of times on here, he does talk about schools and colleges being guilty of this poor this for me is something that I'm quite frustrated by, particularly around the work around growth mindset and mindset studies generally, is that what frustrates me is seeing the intervention getting bad press. When actually, and you read the study and there's no mention of the implementation, when actually what the study should discuss as well as the implementation is the process. What did they actually do? How did they implement? And I know that I think growth mindset, Dweck's work has taken a lot of bad press, which I personally don't feel is fair when you consider some of the studies that have been implemented, the big studies that have been implemented around this have actually been implemented poorly. And it was probably that they didn't get the results that they were looking for rather than the implementation itself, rather than the intervention itself.
No, you're absolutely right. And we talk a lot about that in terms of the research school, that you can implement a bad idea well and a good idea badly. And you've got to be careful on both counts there.
Exactly.
Okay, so just conscious that we're moving into the last section here. So I'm going to obviously ask you a little bit about some of the events that you're doing, some of the Vesper events that you're doing in London and Manchester. So we'll talk about some of those and other things that you're involved in. But before we get to that, have you got two of your 10 final thoughts from the conclusion of the A-level mindset?
Yeah, of course we have. Yeah, excuse me. Towards the end of the book, and I'm just flicking through it now, so if you hear the riffle of paper in the background... Towards the end of the book, we do make 10 very simple recommendations that try and kind of pick off some of the things that we'd been talking about during the course. So I'm going to do number 4 here, which is something about effort. I like on effort number 4, which is about blockers. Those students who recognise that their blockers are internal are more likely to be able to challenge their previous selves and change their behaviour. What we've found with a lot of low-effort students is that their blockers are expressed externally, and they will often blame the teacher, the circumstances, the trip to work, the classroom, their peers. Anything that is outside of their control is often the subject of their ire, as opposed to high-performing students who recognise that most blockers are coming from themselves. I like that one, number 4. What are you going to choose, Steve?
For me, it was number 6 around systems, which says if there is one quality that they find students with good systems is that they snack rather than binge. And this idea that little and often beats cramming hands down So lots around chunking activities, project management, planning out a year rather than as sometimes we all are guilty of it, occasionally doing, leaving everything to the very last minute and then making a charge at the end. So just a system of chunking, recording activities, project managing, I think can have quite a big impact on students' well-being as well as the performance.
No, brilliant, brilliant, absolutely. So just a last little bit now. Obviously, listeners will know a lot about your work, but where can we find out a little bit more and where will you be speaking and what kind of events have you got coming up?
Well, if you want to find us online, we're at vespamindset.com. That's VESPAMINDSET.com. And pretty much everything you need is there to get you started and begin to explore the system. We try and get together with a small number of delegates at least twice a year, as you mentioned, Manchester and London. We like to keep those events small so that people who attend can ask questions and discuss implementation and share practice. And I think the next one's in December, isn't it, Steve? Are we talking December the 6th? Yeah. Friday, December 6th, Central London location to be confirmed. Do you want to pick up from there, Steve?
Yeah, I mean, we're at the usual. We try and do a small number of conferences throughout the year. But one of the things I would say that we've become more conscious of is that we're less. It's become lower impact to work with larger number of schools for us because they don't necessarily implement properly. So most of our work now is spent working with a smaller number of organisations, but working and supporting them on implementation throughout the process.
So we've just finished some really exciting projects with small groups of schools coming together who we will work with 3, 4, 5 times across a year so that we can get them together, we can drop in, we can catch up on what's been going on, we can guide them through the dip in the middle of the programme. So that's increasingly become the way we've organised training. And it's a very rewarding, exciting way to spend time working with schools.
Yeah, I think it's worth just mentioning that as well in terms of implementation, because we've just done a nice project over the last year with 12 Lincolnshire Grammar Schools who all decided to implement VESPA with their Year 12 groups. And I think schools working together collectively on a project of implementation is a really powerful way of making, of supporting each other and making, of driving things forward, of having that audit where you check in that you've done everything that you agreed to do. I think sometimes individual schools can get, as we all do, caught up in the busyness of the day-to-day stuff, and it's a little bit easy to wander off the track that you had designed early on. So my advice would certainly be where schools can come together to work on this collectively as a group and design a proper research project, which is our approach, implementation seems to work far more effectively.
Yeah, we've got a very exciting one in North Wales at the moment that looks that way. It's Steve's focus on accountability. There is an accountability as well as a support, so it works particularly well, I think.
No, I think you're absolutely right about that. It's another thing that we say in the research schools about research being a social process, and it's schools learning from other schools and it's schools working together is where that research and evidence comes alive, really.
Mm. I really like that phrase. It's a social process as opposed to an individual event.
Yeah, I've got loads of these kind of catchphrases, but that's for another podcast. Right, Steve and Martin, can I just say a massive thank you. On a personal level, thank you for the work that you've done across Blackpool and the work that you've done with our school as well. So really appreciate that. And thank you for coming on tonight and everything that you're doing. Really, really appreciate it.
Thanks, Phil. Thanks for letting us do this. It's been really interesting getting us to, you know, we've had to really think through what we're doing here. So it's nice to have that opportunity.
Thank you, Phil. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
This week in the podcast pedagogy section, I have been reading The Educated Guess by Warwick Sharp. And the aim of this book seems to be to make us all aware of the common biases in our thinking and the long-term and short-term effect of these biases. And it struck me that in leading such busy lives in an unnecessarily complex world, we don't give ourselves time to think slowly and logically through every decision we're faced with. And as Warwick expertly points out, with perfectly pitched examples, we rely a lot on our intuition, subconsciously making quick and automatic judgments based on our experiences. And this reminded me of much of the early work of research schools in enabling teachers to become critical consumers. And I'm always reminded about the quote from Sir Kevin Collins, that if you're not using evidence, then you must be using prejudice. And this is, of course, often subconscious and can also be down to the accepted narrative of the time, particularly in education. I really enjoyed Warwick challenging common education myths with reason and, of course, evidence. His experience in education policy, teaching and governance pitch this book perfectly. So as we know, the issue of choice has become increasingly more important in education, and this very handy guide, in my view, makes that choice more informed. So the book is available via Amazon and at theeducatedguess.org.uk, and I'm delighted to say that Warwick will be a guest. I think I'm interviewing him on the week of the 18th of November, so I look forward to speaking to him about this book fairly soon. Moving into the shameless plugs section, and I'd like to start by thanking Dame Alison Peacock and Joe Treacy for my certificate recognising fellowship of the Chartered College. I'm so excited about this, I'm going to share it on the video for this week's podcast, but I'm absolutely passionate about using my teacher voice to help the profession in any way that I can, so I look forward to getting involved in some more work with the Chartered College. I'd also like to mention friend of the show Emma Turner's New Ed Conference taking place this weekend, and this is backed by the Chartered College. And also exciting news in the world of education is that Emma's book is out pretty soon, so if you want to check that out as well, have a look on her Twitter feed for more details about that. Back to New Ed, and this is being backed by the Chartered College, and I'm excited that we will be involved in Blackpool in the rollout of this up in the north, so stay tuned for more details. Speaking of the north, I'll be speaking at BrewEd Aussie, and for those of you not from the north, we'll be thinking I'm off to Australia. I'm not. This is Oswaldwistle, which is in Lancashire, and this will be on Saturday the 1st of February. So this is done by Sarah Bedwell, who did Lead Learn Lancs so successfully. So tickets for that are selling fast, and check out the link on the show notes for information about that, or head over to Eventbrite. I'll also be presenting, as I've mentioned previously, at Research Ed Birmingham, and all tickets for that are sold out, but I think there is a waiting list now. And I've also been placed on the subs bench for Ruth Walker's Research Ed Telford, which looks like it will be an amazing event. So I'll be busily warming up on the sidelines just in case someone gets injured. Okay, next week on the show, I'm spoilt for choice following my half-term recording spree. So keep tuned in for updates via the usual channels or the website, which is nailersnatter.co.uk. Can I just say thank you for listening as always, and see you next week.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA 1977 on Twitter.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.